You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 14th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Top of the evening to you.
So this is Pi Day, 314.
It's Pi Day.
Pi Day.
And
but only in the U.S.
Really?
That's well, yeah, because they do... Well, no, it's just because they would call it 14-3 almost everywhere else in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so they're like, what are you really? Talking about? So
that makes sense.
True. U.S.
But the show's
month
being
day.
Released on St. Patrick's Day. That's why I said top of the evening to you.
Oh, look at that.
Combined right. Pi and St. Patrick's Day.
Unfortunately, this is also the day that we learned Stephen Hawking passed away.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Well,
bummer. Crap.
It's the day he technically passed away, but we learned about it yesterday because he's across the dateline.
Yeah. It was just over into 314
yeah.
where he was living, but we heard about it hour late last night. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, technically, he died on March 14th.
Yep. And I heard it from right. Kara first. I saw your email.
Yeah. Well, and you know, because it's, you know, I live in LA, so it's earlier here. So we were at dinner when we saw it on our phones. I met Stephen Hawking once in my life at his birthday party at Kip Thorne's house 6 years ago, and it was St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. So
that's cool.
I know. Right, it was like almost 6 years to the day that I met mm-hmm. him.
Yeah. That was a touching piece, Kara.
How oh, you thank you.
Described the evening and how it took him. You know, a good chunk of the evening just to sort of express a few sentences.
Yeah, I sat with him for about 2 hours or so, and he was able to get about a sentence and a half out, which
damn.
Apparently I've talked to some of my like friends and colleagues who have met him, and they said, you know, that's kind of more than they've experienced. And it was tough, you know. It was a situation where I was in Kip Thorne's home. It was a special birthday for Dr. Hawking. I was an invited guest from friends of friends. It took a lot for me to sit down and decide to write that piece. I wasn't sure if it was invasive or not. I wasn't doing reporting while I was there. It was a very personal blog post. Kip Thorne was not pleased with it when I posted it. And there was a lot of difficulty. Yeah, and discussion around it after I posted it. You know, Kip Thorne and Stephen Hawking were best friends. And I think Kip has always been really protective of Dr. Hawking. And I think for a lot of people, seeing the human side of him and the frailty and the difficulty that comes with such a severe disorder like ALS, like motor neuron disease. And in my piece, I wrote a lot about his struggles. And I don't think that that went over very well, which is completely understandable. So at the time, it was a really tough thing for me. I wrote this piece where I poured my heart out. And then I was really proud of myself as a young journalist. And then it was basically like, this offends me. You're never welcome back at my home again.
Wow.
Oh, gee whiz.
Yeah.
Oh, it's too bad.
Yeah, I mean, Hawking was definitely a great science communicator. I mean, his book, A Brief History of Time, bestseller for weeks, many weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Still one of my favorite science books.
Oh, absolutely. It was a kind of, I mean, this is in the late 80s. Kind of a watershed moment, I think, in science popularization. I mean, it's
sure.
a lot, that's what, 10, 20, 30 years ago. It's crazy, you know, it's a long time ago. They weren't very common back then. And I'm just looking at the list of books he's written, more than I actually thought he did. But I've seen a bunch that I've read, Brief History of Time, Universe in a Nutshell, A Briefer History of Time, Black Holes and Baby Universes are just so much great writing. And to think that he was so prolific and yet, you know, would take a long time just to get a sentence out when communicating makes it even more remarkable. Yeah, just an amazing, amazing guy. And I remember reading about the making of A Brief History of Time. And I think he had some equations in the book. And they're like, every time you put an equation in the book, you cut your audience in half. And he was just like, he was aghast at the prospect of that. But he made sure that some equations, some of the big ones like E equals MC squared was definitely in there.
I think that was the only one, right?
It might be the only one.
The only equation in the book was E equals MC squared.
Oh, that's interesting. It is. It's funny you say that, Bob, because you're right. I didn't really think about it. I was born in 83. So science communication from the time I was a child, popular science writing, has been in existence. You know, Carl Sagan was actually a little before my time. I was a little bit unaware of the impact when I was quite young, and I only grew to learn about Carl Sagan, for example. But so many people liken Stephen Hawking unto Albert Einstein, but we didn't get to read Einstein. Like, I mean, we read interpretations of Einstein, and maybe some people read his actual papers, but he wasn't writing best-selling paperbacks.
No.
You know what I mean? It's so interesting to think about that. You're right. It, like, Stephen Hawking doing this was like a major, major game changer. Somebody at that level, somebody who is compared to the mind of Einstein all the time, wrote a book that, like, mere mortals could read.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think what really, at least initially, played into his popularity was his story. Obviously, he has an amazing story. This is a guy that was basically given 2 years to live, and now 55 years later, now he died 55 years later. So that's a great story that he's lived so long. But he's in a wheelchair, couldn't talk, and all this stuff. So that kind of played into the popularity, I think. And it was always, I mean, if you read those early reviews, people would always, you know, mention that and like, oh, he can only use two or three or four fingers on one hand, and nobody got that number right, he used to say. But that's the way it was. Unfortunately, it took that human interest story to really, I think, help him become initially popular. But he's just such a fantastic scientist and popularizer that I think that just took over very quickly.
I think he found the perfect level of complexity to communicate cosmology to a general audience. You know,
not an easy thing to do, especially when you're at his level. It must be easy to throw out vocab words that most people be like, what the hell? And you kind of lose the sense of what people should know or what words they know. And that's changed in 30 years. You know, words that you wouldn't want to throw around 30 years ago. I'm sure you could throw around an accretion disk and black hole jets without, even worrying about it.
Yeah.
Well, that's what makes someone, a true science communicator is having their finger on that. It's hard, I mean, using us as an example, I'm constantly learning as we produce this show and increasing my understanding of things and vocabulary. And, I sometimes lose my sense of what I think, people who don't read as much as I do about this, what they know and what they think. I try not to use particular words that I think are confusing, right? But when you're doing something on the level that Stephen Hawking was, like you were saying, Bob, it's all confusing and heady and conceptual.
Mm-hmm.
For him to communicate as well as he did with the issues that he had just in writing, I mean, think about it. His process was so amazingly slow. He just spent his time thinking, as best he could, how to communicate to the most people, and it worked. He really had a knack for it.
It's a rare gift to be able to translate the language of physics, the language of mathematics, into something that everyday people can really absorb and understand, frankly. And Hawking certainly paved the way for the generation that followed of science communicators, of actual scientists who would step forward, write books, be on television, produce series, and do all these things that we enjoy and sort of take for granted today. You just turn on your television, you get numbers of them. But it was Stephen Hawking who was certainly one of the first ones. He pioneered it in a sense.
So, Hawking was told when he was 22 that he only had 2 to 3 years to live when he got his diagnosis. Okay, so he's 22 years old, and he goes on in 1942. He was born in Oxford, England, and then he attended Oxford University in 1959. And then he immediately went on to his PhD at Cambridge. And when his ALS diagnosis came in 1963, it was only a decade after that, just over a decade, 1974, where he submitted his theory that black holes emit radiation, right? Hawking radiation. And given enough time, they would evaporate into nothing. And that was a very novel idea at the time. And then in 1979, he was given a prestigious title of Lucasian Professor of Mathematics at Cambridge. And some other people's names you might recognize also had that title, Isaac Newton and Charles Babbage, among a host of other people. And then in 88 is when he published a Brief History of Time. And that went on to sell more than, guess how many copies, guys?
Brief History of Time?
Yeah.
50?
Oh, 50 million?
It's 10 million. Million is huge, yeah.
Just kidding, sorry.
Huge.
10 million is huge. I know, you guys are just guessing crazy high, but... And he lost his ability to speak, and then he started using the voice synthesizer. And he was typing with a mechanism in his hand, like a handheld switch. And then when he couldn't do that, he used his cheek.
Yeah,
that's type. What he was using when I saw him. Yeah, his cheek. Yeah, a lot of people assumed that it was like an eye blinking thing or that it was like a scanning thing, but it was really the way that the machine worked was the cursor continuously scrolls through all the letters of the alphabet and a couple of like simple phrases and words, and he twitches the muscles in his cheek with a little tiny sensor that was attached to his glasses that set on his cheek, and it stopped the cursor in his tracks. But was frustrating for, as I could tell, his aides and also his friends is that, as you might expect from somebody like Dr. Stephen Hawking, who is absolutely brilliant, he did not want to slow the scroll down because I'm sure it was annoying to him. And so he would continuously miss the letter he was trying to get.
Yeah, yeah.
It would actually make the whole process much slower because he would have to cycle through multiple times before he would stop where he wanted to stop. But he refused to slow the system down because I think it was too frustrating for him.
That's got to be just beyond any kind of frustration we can understand.
Yeah.
He once said, it would not be much of a universe if it wasn't home to the people you love. And, you know, as Kara was alluding to before, I mean, there was a, you see pictures of him and you read his words, but this was a funny person. Has been described to have vigor for life, you know, loving, just a wonderful guy. So another great thing about him, which was a lot of fun throughout the years, throughout the decades, was seeing him on TV shows and in the movie about him. So, you know, just to name a few, he was on The Simpsons and Star Trek The Next Generation, Big Bang Theory. Yeah. And then The Theory of Everything, which was the film that outlined the earlier part of his life. Did you guys know that Hawking is particularly appreciated in China?
What does that mean?
No.
His books were just widely, widely read in China. Cool. So there's, you know, generations of people that were familiar with him. And I think he was out there in early 2000s and he, you know, just had a huge response to his visit. You know, just a overall from the people that I'm seeing responses from people that knew him or got to meet him, they're all saying very similar things. Just a wonderful, warm, just a beautiful person. Unfortunately, just locked in a situation, you know. But still, look at what he did, guys. Look at what he did from that chair.
So it's interesting symmetry. A lot of people are pointing out that Hawking was born on the 300-year anniversary of Galileo's death. And then he died on not only Pi Day, but Einstein's birthday. Galileo, but if you guys, you know, we talk about scientists being science communicators, you know, Galileo wrote a book, Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, which is basically a science communication book for the masses. You know, it was written as a conversation among three people. And, you know, so that you could explain the, you know, the whole idea of the heliocentric solar system. So, yeah, so the tradition of popularizing science goes back a long way.
And I really recommend that everybody look up this YouTube video. It's called Quantum Chess, and it's starring Keanu Reeves and Paul Rudd. Keanu Reeves actually does all of their narration for it, which is super random. And then Paul Rudd plays Quantum Chess with Stephen Hawking in the video, and it's funny. It's so funny.
Really?
Like he just has, yeah, it's like he has the best sense of humor in it. So you can, you know, just go to YouTube and put like Quantum Chess Stephen Hawking or Quantum Chess Paul Rudd, and you'll find the video really readily. And yeah, it's called Stephen Hawking Faces Paul Rudd in an Epic Chess Match. And it's to promote this quantum chess game that was developed through some work at Caltech and some of the other cool stuff that they do in the Institute for Quantum Information and Matter. But yeah, it was, I don't know, really exciting that I was really close to a lot of the people that went into developing that and that he was so game to do something so just like silly and fun and funny.
Oh, they said he had a great sense of humor.
Yeah. Like just, really, it's really a very recent, oh, it's called Anyone Can Quantum. That's the name of the video. I love that. It's just a very recent example of that because it was made just in 2016.
Hawking also appeared in that video celebrating the Monty Python anniversary with Brian Cox, in which they you know, basically sang a song together, essentially. And, you know, he also did things like he appeared in at least one Futurama, if not several.
Yeah.
And I know one of the Futurama episodes he showed up and he did with Gary Gygax, the creator of Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, that's cool.
So, I mean, you're having this geek orgasm basically watching this particular Futurama all at the same time. You see Hawking, you see Gygax, like, ah, you're going crazy. He's so funny. Really had a great sense of humor.
All right. Well, let's move on with the rest of the show. Bob, you're going to get us started off with a forgotten superhero of science.
Yeah, this week for Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm going to talk about Brenda Milner, 1918 to still alive. She is a neuropsychologist who has contributed so much over the years to the field that she's been called the founder of neuropsychology. And to top it all off, she still is working well into her 90s. Amazing. Actually, 99. She'll be 100 later this year. Milner worked for 30 years as a neuropsychologist with the Montreal Neurological Institute. There, she famously worked on patient HM, who many people, I'm sure, already know who I'm talking about. He mm-hmm. lost his ability to convert short-term memory into long-term memory. And just think about that. We've talked about that on the show before. It's a devastating condition. But the memories that Milner were able to consolidate from experiments on HM opened up our understanding of the brain. Specifically, she showed that he could learn some tasks, revealing for the first time that the brain has more than one type of memory system. Let's see, she also did early fundamental work on how the hemispheres of the brain communicate, which had enormous implications for understanding language and learning and sensation. And this is a topic actually that she is still working on in her role today as the Dorothy J. Killam Professor of the Montreal Neurological Institute. And she's a professor in the Department of Neurology and Neurosurgery at McGill University at 99. I'll be lucky at her age if I could still binge watch Netflix movies. So it's just incredible that she's still productive. So yes, remember Brenda Milner, mention her to your friends. Perhaps when discussing a collateral eminence or Kalkaran fissures, or perhaps somatogenic phenomenology. So a collateral eminence, that's actually a structure within the hippocampus, which is crucial for memory. I thought that was a really cool name, collateral eminence.
So first news item, I'm going to talk about the brain's predictive coding. You guys know what predictive coding is?
Wait, was that with a D or a T?
Coding.
Okay.
Just right. Checking.
Oh, coating. Yeah.
Not its predictive coating.
Coating.
That would be bizarre.
It's a nice veneer it has.
Meninges that predict things.
Yeah, so actually it is a computer term that has been borrowed by neuroscientists. And it is a hypothesis about how the brain deals with information. So we've talked a lot on the show because I think this is one of the core lessons for skeptics that the brain constructs our perception of reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a passive just perception of what's going on around you. There's massive filters and constructive processes going on in real time all the time, and that you're eventually experiencing a seamless, you know, stream of consciousness that is a complete fiction, right? It's constructed from information about the actual world, but it is really just a story that your brain tells you.
So I have my own personal virtual reality going on?
Yeah, right? Basically. And some neuroscientists have likened it to hallucinations. It's just that, you know, there's this one hallucination that
that
feels real to us, you know? Yeah,
wow.
But it's really no different than any other hallucination. That's in fact what hallucinations are, when the construction of reality is markedly out of step, you know, with external reality or with what everyone else thinks is external reality, right?
Wow. It's no wonder we get so many things wrong.
Well, yeah, just your brain's constructing a narrative that's just going off on its own little story, and it's not really basing it in any meaningful way on on what's happening in the real world. That's a hallucination. But the fundamental process is still a constructive process of this experience, this story that our brain tells us. Well, there's always new elements of this constructive process coming to light with neuroscience, and we like to talk about that when something significant comes out. So recent paper was discussing this notion of the predictive coding of the brain, which basically means that there's a couple of things going on here. One, I know we've mentioned before, that the brain has to predict, has to project the construction of reality a little bit into the future, right?
Yeah.
Partly because the processing time itself would mean that we're constantly lagging a couple of hundred milliseconds behind real time, which would be a problem for things like catching a baseball, right? You couldn't know when to do things. So your brain has to actually compensate for the lag by projecting, you know, so what you're experiencing things in real time, it's really just an extrapolation from a couple of hundred milliseconds ago. So that your experience is in sync with real time, compensating for that lag.
So our brain has a physics engine that lets us predict the future.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it really does. You know, one other way that you know that our brain has a physics engine in it is that if somebody is moving in a way that is not exactly 1G, you immediately
know. Oh, you know it.
It does not look real. And when you look at cartoons or at CG, like if they don't get the physics exactly right, it just doesn't look right. Your brain knows it, right?
Yeah, it reminds me of how good our brains are at recognizing faces and seeing moving faces that are off, even the tiniest bit. I mean, you look at, you know, the CG these days is wonderful, but often the CG will fail, especially more in the background or mid frame. It will fail not because of how the CG looks, but because of how the CG moves. Like when they substitute a person, a stunt virtual person, and use that instead of a real person, and they do some crazy stuff, which you see, of course, very often these days with superhero movies and action movies. Man, any movement, even the Spider-Man, some of the Spider-Man moves that he made that were a little CG'd, they're just like, nope, that was cool, but man, something was wrong with it. It was a little bit off. We were just so good at it.
And I think part of the reason why our brains are so good at knowing when something is moving in 1G is because that's also how we tell if something is probably alive or not.
Yeah.
If things are moving in what's called an inertial frame, just passively according to gravity, our brain assumes it's a thing. If something is moving in a non-inertial frame, our brain assumes it's an agent. It has agency. It can act on its own will.
Ooh.
So that means we have to be able to be very sensitive to moving in an inertial frame, which basically means passively with gravity.
I knew there was a good reason.
Yeah. Okay. But this predictive ability of our brain doesn't just compensate for the time lag or extrapolate physics. It also, and this is where the quote unquote predictive coding comes into play, is that we sort of have an expectation about how the world should behave. And we're constantly comparing what we're actually experiencing to what our expectations of what should be happening are. So, for example, let's say, guys, we all live in the country. I don't know how urbanified or rural your area is, Kara, but
because in the country,
we're out in our backyard after sunset in the summer. We're going to hear crickets and tree frogs and, you know,
chirpers.
The soundscape of a rural summer evening, right? Mm-hmm. Our brain expects to hear those sounds. We don't expect to hear like a 18-wheeler's horn go off, you know?
Oh, yeah. I'm the opposite.
Yeah. If you're in the middle of a city, it's exactly the opposite.
Yep.
And so your brain sort of has in the background this contextual expectation of what it's going to experience, and it uses that in order to know what stimuli to filter out and what to pay attention to. So if we hear a car horn, you know, in the middle of nowhere, you know, at the end of my dead-end street, then I notice it because it stands out.
Yeah, and that's my crickets.
And that's your crickets. If you're in the city, I've been in the city, you know, you hear cars honking in the background. Oh, your brain filters
sirens.
It out. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And right. Actually, if it's a lot of crickets, it might be kind of weird. Or if there's a lot of nature sounds outside,
yes.
I might be like, what's happening out there?
Yeah. Or if you hear jungle sounds suddenly. But it's not just the soundscape. It's also, you know, what's happening. You know, it's everything in your environment that your brain sort of it, so in other words, the brain is using its prediction of how the world should be behaving as a way to know what to pay attention to and what to filter out. But further still, there is the brain has to decide how sensitive to make the filter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it basically has to decide, where do I set my filter in order to get rid of the most noise and the least signal?
And it does that with all of our senses, not just...
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah,
and it's like, comparing them to each other.
Yeah, that's why I always talk about like the accommodation thing. That's what, like when I used to teach intro biology, I would always say, that's why you don't feel your shoes around your feet all day.
Yeah.
And if you did, right. It would get really annoying.
Right.
It would. I mean, our senses, our senses seem to be optimized for what's new, what's different. Anything else?
Definitely.
Anything else is just, it fades into the background.
Or what could injure me? Like if you are wearing new shoes, like you said, new, and they're giving you a blister or something, like this is a bad thing.
Yeah.
I am aware of this now.
Yeah, exactly. Pain is that too. So there's an elaborate system. This is the big picture of all the things that you guys are talking about. There's an elaborate system in our brains designed to tell us what to pay attention to, how to fix our attention. The amount of extraneous noise we filter out is phenomenal. So this is sort of the new hypothesis. This is why the researchers are writing this article, is the notion that some disorders may be a disorder of this predictive coding and the threshold of the filter. So specifically, some people with autism. Now, autism is hard to talk about because it's not a homogeneous disorder. Mm-hmm. It's heterogeneous, right? So it's a lot of different things that we call autism because they superficially are very similar, but there may not be identical in terms of the underlying neurological effects. But what they're saying is some people with autism, that maybe they have a disorder of their predictive coding, so they don't know how and what to filter out.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, that seems like – I mean, I've read things about how people with autism – where everything is just bombarding their senses and they can't filter. I mean, that's a classic part of it.
They get sensory overload.
Yeah, it's what happens too when people first turn their new senses on, like people who get cataracts removed or people who get cochlear implants. They describe it as noisy.
Yeah, because their brain hasn't learned how to filter yet.
Yeah.
But also that some people with autism really are obsessed with having very predictable, unchanging environments.
Yeah, and rigid. The way they eat their food that's
Gotta
true.
Watch Judge Wapner. Gotta watch Judge Wapner.
Yeah. Everything's gotta be very predictable because their brain doesn't have an ability to be isn't dynamically or adaptively be able to predict their environment. So they like to keep everything exactly the same reduce to help their filters, right? So that's an interesting hypothesis, you know, that needs to be further explored. There's another layer though here as well, and that is detail versus gestalt. And this is something that's also dynamic, meaning that for any individual, your brain is kind of deciding contextually moment to moment how much to focus on details and how much to focus on the big picture. And what tends to happen is that when confronted with something novel, we focus on the details. And then once we learn the patterns, then we focus on the pattern and filter out the details. Does that make sense? So we use the details to build the pattern. But once we know the pattern, that helps us predict the overall system and we don't have to pay as close attention to the details anymore.
Yeah, so like we check against it until we feel like it's sufficient.
Right. And so that reduces our processing load. Because we're capturing it in an overall gestalt, not having to process all the tiny little details. Because we know the details, and details aren't important anymore. This is what's important, this bigger pattern. But again, if people are impaired in their ability to do that, then they're constantly overwhelmed by details. And so it's just amazing to think about the fact, all these things that our brain is doing in the background, subconsciously, deciding where to focus my attention, what's signal and what's noise, where to set the threshold, what's contextually what is new and what should get my attention and what's predictable in background, and all the time, you know, trying to see patterns and then deciding which details it could kind of gloss over. You know, it's a very dynamic process. When everything is working well, we don't notice it. That's the thing. When everything's working, all we know is the seamless experience of our stream of consciousness. We don't know, but when things start to break down, oh boy, do you notice it, because you weren't even aware that it was a thing until it wasn't working for you anymore. So I see that all the time. I have patients who have traumatic brain injury, right? Basically a severe, you know, severe enough a concussion, we call it a traumatic brain injury. And they basically have acquired deficits of some of these things. So this is all very processing heavy, you know, but the brain's doing it in the background. And when you have a traumatic brain injury, your brain really just loses some of its processing power. The neurons aren't connected to each other as robustly. And so they start to lose the ability to filter out background noise. You know?
Oh, wow.
Or they can't maintain their focus if there's anything that distracts them. So they need to do one thing at a time in a completely distraction-free environment. Like, they need to be alone in a room with no background noise, focusing on one thing.
And it's also interesting how much variation there is from people to people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even in, like, kind of quote-unquote normal brains, healthy brains. I, for example, when I'm doing my homework, I have to wear noise-canceling headphones because the smallest noises around my house really distract me. But I look over and my boyfriend is doing just as complicated stuff for work using like linguistically focused stuff, and he's listening to death metal.
Yeah.
And there's like and there's lyrics in his music.
Yeah,
and I'm
like
how
you.
Are you listening to me? Yeah, it blows my mind. People can listen to music with lyrics and write other words at the same time. For me, that's like, tough. That is insanity.
Bob, remember in Next Generation with Data, listening to like three different types of music at the same time and figuring out a new supplement for his cat and a bunch of other things.
Well, he had true parallel processing. We don't. We have one stream. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That would be cool, though.
Gets back to nobody could really multitask, you know?
There's no multitasking, right?
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. Kara, so what's up with this whole daylight savings time thing? Why do we still have this?
It's funny. I mean, I think this is a topic that we revisit year after year because every year,
twice a
daylight
year.
Savings. Yeah, there you go. Well, but really only once a year does it cause outrage. You know,
yeah.
And that's the time.
Twice a year. Twice a year. Doesn't
no,
it?
Twice a year. It happens once a year. We get mad about it.
Oh, yeah, when we lose the hour.
Yeah, yeah.
Gosh.
And it's pretty funny because there was a little write around. You know, everybody does write arounds around daylight savings because, of course, everybody gets pissed. But there was a little write around in PopSci this go around by Sarah Chodosh. And she did a great job of digging up a lot of research to see, like, is there anything that's really happening when we set our clocks back? Like, is there a real kind of effect? Because, of course, everybody's like, oh, I'm so tired the next morning, and oh, daylight savings is the worst. But does that actually have any sort of downstream effect? So a little bit of background. Daylight savings, of course, it really, why do you guys know much about why we have it?
There's lots of theories.
Yeah.
Well,
there's lots of wives' tales around it, too.
World War One, did it start then?
Farmers, kids waiting for buses, lots of reasons thrown out there. How about barbecue? People who make like barbecues and stuff. So summers were daylight was longer, so they would sell more product. I mean, I don't know what the consensus is these days.
The sugar lobby had something to do with recent changing of the actual dates in which it happens.
So that is an interesting point, and you're right. There are actual lobbies that try and maintain it, especially because daylight savings now is quite good for sports, sporting good lobbies. Like, people play sports outside more often when we have more daylight, and also the retail industry really likes it when the sun sets late. So there are interests that don't want to change this behemoth machine. But apparently, the consensus does seem to be, you're right, Evan, the German Empire and Austria-Hungary introduced a daylight savings time on April 30th, 1916, as a way to conserve coal during wartime. That was the sort of first, like, major national implementation of it. But it was proposed by an entomologist named George Hudson, because he really liked collecting bugs and playing golf.
Very selfish of him.
Wow. Yeah, and he was not a fan of the fact that the days got shorter and shorter and it got darker sooner.
And he,
was
and like, he did something about it.
He was like, why don't we just change our clocks? And so you saw little implementations, like Ontario in this one town implemented it in 1911. But April 30th, 1916th is apparently the first modern national implementation of daylight saving. So I always thought it started in America, did not. And there have been previous examples of daylight savings, like historically, you know, daylight, when clocks weren't quite as good as they are now, they used to just take the daylight and divide it up and that was your day, which makes sense. But now we like live on clocks, right? We have meetings and we keep calendars and things of that nature. So Basically the question is, does bad stuff happen when you lose an hour? And this PopSci article cites a lot of research, some of it statistically significant, some of it just slightly different. Single hour of lost sleep after daylight savings means that 6 days after the transition, there are more car crashes in the U.S. One researcher actually did a study and estimated that it equated only about 302, but still 302 more car deaths over this over 10 years due to daylight savings. Workplace injuries increase. That one might be significant. Stock markets do slightly worse, doesn't appear to be significant. This one's interesting. Steve, this is, I'd love to hear kind of your anecdotal take on, I don't know if you're ever doing, you know, working in the hospital on daylight, or the day after daylight savings, but apparently there are more heart attacks on the Monday after daylight savings. And it's a big increase, 24% increase in heart attacks. The description here, this study, it's called Daylight Savings Time and Myocardial Infarction, and they think that it's linked to the fact that disrupting your sleep cycle really does affect some of the inflammatory factors in your body. And interestingly, when we get an hour more of sleep, 21% decrease in heart attacks the day after that. So that's really interesting. Apparently, judges give harsher sentences, probably because they're sleep deprived and angry. And there are even more miscarriages for women who are doing IVF, but this is a very small difference. But there is, you know, they think there could be some evidence to point to the fact that disrupting, again, your circadian cycle, which really is a very important thing, affects your fertility, a tiny, tiny bit. Apparently, crime goes down. This one makes sense, right? What is the confound there? What is the intervening factor, do you think, with crime going down?
People are lazy.
No.
Is the number
people don't
of
want to commit. Yeah, people don't want to commit crimes in the daylight hours.
Yeah,
most
yeah,
crimes
yeah.
happen in at when it's dark out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
so that one kind of makes sense.
Confounding, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah, but it kind of makes
punch
sense.
Punch people easier in the dark at night.
And apparently, people do spend less time watching TV and more time outside. When we do gain that extra time. And I'll tell you what, as annoyed as I am the day after daylight savings and as much as I'm grumpy about it and do think we should do away with it, man, it's still light outside where I'm living right now while we're recording and I love it.
Wow.
It's more hiking time for me. I get like so much more hiking time. But you know, it's going to naturally shift that way anyway. It's not because of daylight savings completely. That just kickstarts it, right? The days actually do get longer. The sun actually does set later. And that's why you actually don't see daylight savings enacted in most equatorial places on the planet because they don't need it. And also, the closer you get to the poles, they don't often do it either because it doesn't make a big enough effect.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's awesome. That makes sense.
Yep. What do you guys think?
We should get rid of
should
it.
Should we?
Absolutely.
I agree.
Totally
yes.
get rid of it. Fix that shit.
Dump it. It's a pain in the butt.
Listen to the doctor. Have you had any anecdotal experience or have you not even really thought about it, like the day after daylight savings?
I just know that I'm trash the day after daylight savings.
Yeah, there you go.
You know. Yeah, well,
Steve's crazy sensitive with that stuff.
Yeah, that hour is significant.
Certainly my dogs don't realize what's going on. I mean, they are supposed to have dinner at 5 o'clock, you know, each night. And when daylight savings happens, they don't adjust, you know. They're like, all right, whatever time it was yesterday is the same time today.
So. Well, and also it'd be interesting to see, we're so reliant on clocks. And of course, animals are probably just much more reliant on their actual circadian cycles. Our circadian cycles, you know, we have electric lights in our house and we do all these things to try and like trump nature in that way. Like, oh, I'm going to stay up super late. I didn't notice this time. I had so much homework and I went to bed at 4 a.m. on daylight savings night and I was so mad at myself for staying up so late. I literally did not notice while I was writing a paper that the clock accelerated an entire hour. I was just like, how did that happen? I must have been really focused.
Yeah. I mean, Florida recently passed a law making daylight savings time all year round.
No.
Yeah,
that's
heard
so
that.
Confusing. No, yeah. You can't do that. You know that there's like – that's what really gets me is when there's no consensus. It's like we got to just – we got to all decide and try and keep this together. It's already confusing with the like Arizona situation with their time zones.
Yeah.
And then did you know that there's a time zone in Australia that's on the half hour?
Whoa.
I have heard of some
odd time zones that exist
around the planet. Yes.
Yeah, Australia has three time zones: Western Standard, which is UTC plus 8, Central Standard, which is UTC plus 9:30, and Eastern, which is UTC plus 10. Why would you do that?
To get recognition
to confuse everyone.
Yeah, why the 9:30 though? I don't get that.
I mean, the good news is everybody lives on the coast in Australia. Like, you know, there's not that many people in Australian Central Standard Time. But why would you do that?
I know
it's so
why.
Confusing.
They couldn't agree as to which hour it would be, so the compromise was halfway.
But it's 8, 9:30, and 10.
Well, I'm not saying it makes perfect sense, but you know, these compromises happen.
So confusing.
Just do away with it, please.
Please.
It's one of those things. It's crazy. Like, everyone seems to agree it's a bad idea. It's archaic. It doesn't really do anything. It causes problems. And yet it persists.
Yeah, because it's of weird. Lobbying. That's like the people actively. And it's
who's lobbying? Who wants it?
The retail industry. Heavily.
Yeah, but again, like Florida, just make it daylight savings time all year round. So there's no – it's the transition which kills people.
That's true. Wait, how does that affect them then in the winter? Because it is true, when we fall back, everybody's really happy to get the extra hour, but then they're like, ugh, I go to work in the dark and I come home in the dark and it's terrible.
Yeah, but that's always going to be the case. That's
exactly.
The shorty. It means it's, you get a little bit more light in the evening, a little bit less light in the morning. That's what it would mean.
Yeah. And it's accelerated anyway, because by the time you're at peak, what is it, the summer solstice and the winter, like, it's as bad as it's going to be anyway.
Yeah.
You're just trying to force the hand early.
Whatever. I agree. I think daylight savings time year round. That's the way to go. We should just make it nationwide.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed. Let's do something about this.
Get her done.
Make it happen.
So, Bob, I understand we're going to have fusion reactor plants in 15 years.
Fingers are crossed. Fusion energy was in the news recently. MIT and Commonwealth Fusion Systems, which is actually a spinoff company of from MIT, announced on March 8th that the state of the art superconductors could soon allow fusion reactors that finally produce more energy out than goes in. In other words, energy positive fusion. Now, okay, I can't help but be excited about this one, even though they say it could take 15 years. I mean, for decades they were saying fusion is 30 to 50 years away, and it always will be. So now it's 15 years away.
Then they weren't wrong.
Some of the advances here are interesting. So let's see what they're all about. Now, of course, fusion energy is considered the holy grail of renewable energy. It'd be essentially an almost limitless source of fairly clean, carbon-free energy. It'd make a fantastic, unchanging baseline energy source that other variable sources that are renewable, like solar and wind, could kind of sit on top of.
Yeah.
So you know what I mean? So that would, for the baseline energy usage, we can use fusion. And then for the stuff that's variable and intermittent, we could use the other stuff, whatever. Fusion will definitely have a place. Now, fusion energy, of course, is the process that stars use to shine and exemplify what E equals MC squared is all about. Hydrogen atoms combine to form helium that weigh a little bit less than the hydrogen atoms that went into creating it. And that tiny bit of mass is turned into energy and released as light. And suns do it very, very well. Now for tokamak reactors.
What about daughters though?
Oh, no.
Sorry. Hey, I always delete it. Don't have to keep it.
That was good. Now, for tokamak reactors, the squishing and the heat required to do that on Earth is such a complex prospect that after many millions of dollars have been spent since the 1940s, like I said, the joke is that fusion energy is 30 years away. And always will be.
Well, Bob, on that score, though, I have to say.
Yes.
So the same group 3 years ago predicted they would have a prototype in 10 years. And now they're saying 15 years. So the time is getting longer.
Yeah. That seems to be a little bit counterintuitive. But yeah, I know. It's this reminds me of battery technology where there's these little mini or big breakthroughs all the time. And you just become totally inured to it. And you're just like, whatever. But this fusion, if this works, this is going to change everything. So and this is MIT, you know, I'm still going to give them a little bit of street cred here. So let's see. So one of the big problems is it's not maintaining a fusion reaction. You may think that that's the big problem. No. We've been doing that since the 90s. But what we haven't been able to do is maintain it and extract energy from it as well. It's just so – and part of the reason, it's just so energy intensive makes it hard to do. Plus, there's lots of reasons. So let's see. So the critical component that MIT is counting on to finally make all this work are essentially the superconductors, as I mentioned, specifically the compound YBCO, yttrium barium copper oxide, which has only recently become available commercially. Now, I've heard of this stuff, these compounds, for years now, but I didn't realize that it was really more of a laboratory item for all that time, and only recently has this version become available commercially. So the idea here is that you coat that compound, you put it onto steel tape, and when you do that, you can create a much smaller but still very, very powerful magnets. So that's really the crux of this entire thing, what I just said. It's all about these magnets, these superconductors. Now, actually, so their first primary milestone now will take 3 years. So in 3 years, they will reach the first milestone. And if they don't reach this, they're done. They're cooked. Game over with this specific thing that they're trying to do here. So at the end of that time, MIT and Commonwealth Fusion Systems and other investors, which they do have some already, some investing millions, they hope to have the world's most powerful large bore superconducting electromagnets. That's the goal in 3 years that they say they could potentially have this. They could create a magnetic field 4 times stronger than any existing now in any fusion experiment. This could then allow an order of magnitude increase in the power of the arc reactor. Oh, sorry. I mean, tokamak reactor. So the next milestone could take 10 years, but this would be another good one. This could finally produce what we've actually been waiting for, a prototype reactor that can actually produce more energy than it consumes. I mean, that's what we're waiting for. It's so frustrating to hear these people over the decades. I've read people say, all right, we're going to start building our next prototype fusion reactor. And this one, you know, we'll learn so much that maybe the one after that or the one after that will actually produce more energy. No, that the goal would be that this next one will be able to do this. They really did it this time. They're calling it Spark, SPARC, and the plan is that it will pulse for 10 seconds. Each 10 second pulse could conceivably produce 100 megawatts, enough for a small to a medium sized city. And that's just from the prototype. Okay, now if that succeeds, here's another chain of ifs. Mm-hmm. If that succeeds, that would then lead to the final design and build of a power plant twice the size of Spark's diameter for commercial power output. This would produce 200 megawatts of electricity. So this is their plan over the next 15 years. Huh? Now, Stephen Dean, head of the Fusion Power Associates, which is an advocacy group in Maryland, he said, if MIT can do what they are saying, and I have no reason to think that they can't, this is a major step forward. Okay. Yeah, that's what I've been saying. If they can do it, this would be
big
great.
If.
It's a big if. Now, some people have asked, they say, well, you know, how could superconducting magnets make that much of a difference, really being the entire tipping point? And it really can, though, according to what my research said. And the MIT news website pretty much said it the best. This is how they explain why the superconducting magnets are so absolutely critical. So they said, the way these high field magnets slash the size of plants needed to achieve a given level of power has repercussions that reverberate through every aspect of the design. Components that would otherwise be so large that they would have to be manufactured on site could instead be factory built and trucked in. Ancillary systems for cooling and other functions would all be scaled back proportionately, and the total cost and time to design and construction would be drastically reduced. So that's it. I mean, this is such an amazing possibility, an amazing change that it impacts the entire design of the entire plant. Everything would be smaller and cheaper. So I have an analogy alert. So how would car design and cost change if a cheap, less complex combustion engine that fit entirely in the glove box? Now it's not a perfect analogy, but I think you get the idea. You would have so many more design options. It would be so much cheaper. So much about the production line change of that construction of that car would change because the entire engine fits right in the glove box.
But Bob, the more powerful magnets not only reduce the construction cost and design and everything of the tokamak.
Makes it hotter.
Well, it's also, it reduces the cost of powering it in energy, right?
Yes. So
you have to get past the point where you're producing more energy than it consumes. It takes a lot of energy to make those really powerful magnetic fields. And the better, the more superconducting the magnets are, the more of a magnetic field you could generate with less energy. So that's why they think they're going to finally be able to get over that threshold where they're producing more energy than they're consuming.
Yeah, exactly. I was kind of implying that. I should have said that more explicitly. But yeah, that's exactly it. This is so much more efficient and powerful so that seems to be one of the ways they're doing this, is that they're gonna get past break even by making it much easier or much less power and energy intensive in order to superheat that plasma. And so it's going to be so much easier to do that they'll reach break even sooner, even sooner than they normally would have. So yeah, that's kind of the idea. So I'm going to track this. I mean, I'm definitely going to be talking about this again in a few years and say, all right, MIT, where are you with those superconducting magnets? I mean, come on, give me a progress report. They need to email me a progress report directly, because I'm going to really be following this, because this really seems like I'm just going to, hope that they are right, because this would be such a game changer. We've been talking about fairly clean fusion energy, limitless fusion energy for how many decades, Steve, Jay, we've been talking about this crap. And, if this could do it, that would be great. But
just generically, mm-hmm. You take any prediction about this kind of development, and I think if you just double their projection, you're probably in the ballpark.
Yeah.
Right? So if you say like 30, I bet you anything where 30 years is probably a much better estimate than 15.
Oh, it's like home renovations. It's like when your contractor says it'll take 6 months.
Oh.
Yeah. That is true. That is a good
rule of thumb.
Algorithm.
Heuristic.
Yeah, that definitely is good. Because don't forget, they're looking for investors, people. To me, that kind of
it's a huge makes red flag, you even,
yeah, that's a big red flag. Be very careful about these statements when they're looking for millions of dollars from investors. But the cool thing is, I don't have to wait 15 years. I mean, if they can produce these magnets in 5 years or 6 years, that's not that far away. And to me, like I said, and I hope I made it clear, these magnets seem to be the absolute key for the reason that they could do this. And if they come up with these, if they can make them in 3 to 6 years or even 10 years, then you could have even more hope that, oh boy, maybe we could really do it now, as long as they have that.
Yeah, but it is looking increasingly like eventually we will be able to have fusion reactors. So for me, the real question is it going to be soon enough? Is this going to be replacing other forms of energy on the grid in time to have an impact on global warming? And I think
that's just it.
No matter how you slice it, the answer is no. We're not going to get enough of these things online for this to be our answer to global warming. We will have already exceeded our carbon budget by then.
That's a big part of this.
We still need to push renewables and energy efficiency and all that stuff.
Of course.
And eventually, of 100 years or whatever, eventually we will be probably
totally
have
off of it.
A fusion infrastructure, or I think, as you say, we're always going to need on-demand baseload you know, energy production.
Right.
The thing about renewables, some people, like when I wrote about this, they said, oh, no, renewables are cheaper. This is never going to be cost effective to renewables. I'm like, yeah, but the problem with renewables like solar and wind is that they're not on demand. And now you're talking about grid storage, and having viable, cost-effective grid storage is more of a moonshot than friggin' fusion energy, in my opinion, at this point. You know what I mean? What are we going to have sooner? Cheap, massive grid storage or fusion energy? That's a pretty close call, I think. I don't even know what the answer to that is.
Yeah.
So you can't gloss over one and you know what I mean, and criticize the other. I think these are both issues.
Yeah. Go for all of it. Go for all of it. I mean, try all of those. They're all, if, you know, if some fail, fine. Some, all you need to do is succeed with a couple of them, and we are in really, really good shape.
That's why I think we shouldn't give up on bridging technologies. Like, yeah, absolutely. Let's maximize renewables. But you know what? Maybe we need some more fission, you know, nuclear power plants for the next 50, 60 years until we solve these other technological issues like grid storage or fusion reactors.
So, Steve, you know, what you're saying is coal is bad.
Yeah, basically.
All right. Just want to be clear.
Well, it's just that, you know, it's actually the – it's, you know, we all know what's wrong with coal. It's dirty. It releases a lot of carbon. But the thing is that I like to emphasize –
it's coarse. It gets everywhere.
It gets everywhere. The thing is that even if you just consider the health effects, it's like the most expensive energy production. Yeah. Right? If you count the externalized costs of just the health costs, just the health care
costs.
Yeah,
and that's both of the people – people breathing in all of the emissions, but also of the poor people that are mining this stuff and working with it. Like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's also like the most dangerous energy too, just because it has the highest death rate, you know, in terms of mining and everything.
Terrible.
Yeah, it is. We need to, so if, that's why almost anything is better than coal.
You don't need a canary in a nuclear reactor. That's
you might actually.
I don't think
got your counter at least.
And Steve, they actually addressed climate change in this and for this topic. Yeah. This is Bob Mungard. He's the CEO of Commonwealth Fusion Systems. He said the aspiration is to have a working power plant in time to combat climate change. We think we have the science, speed, and scale to put carbon-free fusion power on the grid in 15 years. So,
sounds nice.
See, that's the thing. That's exactly the reason why we have to be realistic about these projections. And if he's like, don't worry, guys, we're going to have you covered. We're going to technology our way out of global warming. In 15 years, we're going to have this. I would not bet on that. I would not bet on that. I think we need to proceed as if we're never going to get fusion. And then when one day, if it arrives, great. But until then, we have to be proceeding as if it's never going to happen.
And we need to invest. I think we need to invest in it. I mean, it's not just for our energy grid. I mean, I want to see fusion rockets in space. Come on.
Well, but you're right. You know, again, like their MIT attracted $50 million of investment. That's nothing. That's peanuts. Even if, like, if we invested $10 billion in developing this fusion energy project, that would be worthwhile. We would make our money back on that investment, probably many orders of magnitude over. It's a worthwhile investment. Just avoiding the externalized costs of other forms of energy, it's worth the investment. That is an investment that, you know, on the future.
Right. And don't drop billions just on this specific one. Also invest in inertial confinement, which is another way to, it's a completely different method than tokamak reactors. Put some in there, you know, just spread it around. One of them's going to hit. The thing is, the cool thing is all you need is one of these to hit. Like, oh, we spend so much money. But yeah, look how the world would change if one of these hit, regardless whether it's tokamak or inertial confinement. If one of them's hits, we are done. We are set.
All right, Jay. It's Who's That Noisy time.
So last week I played this noisy. So...
Now, Jay, admit it. Last week, I nailed it. I said it was a rocket. We didn't include it
rocket
in the show.
Well,
duh.
For the TV rocket. Guitar thing to come in.
Yeah, but I want more specific, more data, Steve.
Which rocket? SpaceX rocket.
It's the Saturn V.
More data, please.
It is a retro rocket landing.
It's the V2.
As one recorded through an iPhone.
One more time. You are all correct. I need one more piece of data.
It's
a rocket through the...
It's Elon Musk's recording.
Medium of Earth's atmosphere?
Oh, Evan, you're tipping right on the edge, Ev. You're right there.
Oh, whoa, okay.
All right, let's go to the worst guesses from last week, okay? And I will remind our audience, when I do worst guesses, I'm not trying to mock you directly. It's just so funny to me, like, how many different things people can hear. So David Barlow said, this week's noisy sounds like a mosquito getting zapped in a bug zapper.
No.
Slowed down, perhaps. I thought that was interesting. I said it's labeled as the worst guess. It was a fun guess. K. Ole Avin Ulebo.
Ooh, that's a cool name.
Yep. K. Ole. She said, could be a guy, right?
K?
K. Ole.
Yeah, it could be either one.
This person said, I was thinking this week's noisy is something metallic or percussive, but I think I know what it is. Is it a theremin?
Ha ha. The old
daddy guy. Always a good guess.
That is such a go-to. Both incorrect. And then got a couple more guesses over here. These were a little bit better. William Silburn said, love the podcast. First time emailing for Who's That Noisy? And then he says, this week's noisy sounds to me like an acetylene torch flaring up as the welder presses the lever, increasing the oxygen content of the flame. Once the welder does this, they can begin to cut through steel like butter for however long they need.
Wow.
Like
so butter. That's actually, you know what? If you've heard an acetylene torch turn on or get turned on.
Yeah.
It kind of, yeah, there is a little bit of that in there. So the winner, this week's winner, HSJ, said, that sound is the Falcon Heavy side booster landing burns. Audio sounds distorted, but I've watched hundreds of different recordings of it. So it was the first and only thing that came to mind. It never gets old. Okay, but there is a piece of information that is happening in here. Now, when you listen to the noisy, what are those big booms?
Ejection?
Sonic booms.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, those are them, I guess, slowing down. But they are, you know how a sonic boom works? It's not like when it's constantly making a sonic boom. You guys aware of this?
Yeah.
You
know?
Yes.
I mean, yes.
Yeah, when something is, when something is going the speed of sound, it's not just one boom. It's constantly making a boom. It's boom. You're just constantly making that noise, right? Is that correct, Steve?
Yes. And then you hear it when it passes you.
Right.
Right. At your given point.
Yeah. So the wavefront passes you, yeah.
So the retro rockets were going faster than the speed of sound, and that was them coming back down, and that was what the mics picked up. So that was the ultimate thing I was looking for. Nobody got that, but HSJ definitely got the closest. Great job.
Well done.
Mm-hmm.
So in that audio, you could hear three sonic booms. This week's noisy was sent in by a listener named John Klesmerud.
I like it.
Breaking news.
So if you think you know what the noisy is this week, or you have something awesome that you heard, email me at WTN@theskepticsguy.org.
Thank you, Jay. Just a couple of quick follow-ups this week. So, Jay, you mentioned last week that NASA invented duct tape. They never did. You were a liar.
You
did I say
liar.
Invented or used?
I'm disappointed in you, Jay. No, so yeah, a couple of people pointed out to us that duct tape has a long history, actually. It goes back. It was used something like it in World War II and before. And
it's, was it first used on ducts?
It was called duct tape initially, and then duct tape in the 1970s.
Oh,
because it was used for heating ducts, duct work.
But that's not how it started?
Not how it started, nope. So here's the thing. It was used by NASA extensively, and they say that there was duct tape aboard every NASA flight going back to the Gemini missions, and that they did use it on Apollo 13. It was used on various missions. And in fact, it was one of the technicians who was involved with trying to recover from the technical problem on Apollo 13 said, as soon as he saw their the list of equipment they had on the capsule, and he saw that there was duct tape there, he knew that he would be able to solve the problem. So, like, once he knew that that was among the material they had access to, he knew he'd be able to find a solution.
Awesome. Wow.
But NASA did not invent it.
Okay, I stand corrected. Now, this is a perfect example of a piece of information that I had banging around in my head.
Right.
It felt truthful.
It had truthiness about it.
Truthiness. Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't. But no flags were raised when I recalled the information, but yet I was wrong.
But that Tang orange drink, that they...
Hey, now come on.
Oh, wait.
but that's what happens. That's what happens. That's why it's apocryphal, is that... Our memories make the story better over time, right? So you have this story of NASA using duct tape, and that evolves into NASA invented duct tape, you know? So that's just the way our brains work. We sacrifice the details for the theme and the emotion and the impact of the story.
Screw the details.
Yeah, that's basically where our brain's wired.
Yeah. I don't have time for details.
Yeah.
All right. Also, some Amelia Earhart follow-up. So last week, one of the sciences on our science fiction was that a researcher published a paper in which he claims that the bones found on an island in 1940 were those of Amelia Earhart. And it was science because it was true that somebody published that study. But some people thought that that meant that the story itself was reliable. So I did push the envelope a little bit this one. I will admit that usually I don't include as science news items that I don't think are that reliable. You know what I mean? I usually will make them the fiction, but mm-hmm. I thought you guys might have heard this one. And, you know, this was meant to be a little tricky because it was worded very specifically. And then we did also have a very open discussion about how unreliable I thought the claims were. But I did want to clarify, I don't believe for a second that the bones that guy was describing are Amelia Earhart's.
Really?
Did you make the bones joke? I know I wasn't there for
look
that.
At the bones? Yes, I think somebody
yes.
said that.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Good. Excellent.
Right.
Just making sure.
No, so, you know, the bottom line is that there really isn't any credible historian who thinks that Amelia Earhart landed on any island anywhere. She ditched in the ocean. She really wasn't within any flying distance of that island. Just if you reconstruct the evidence that we do have, the only plausible scenario is that she missed her destination and was in the middle of nowhere and had to ditch. That's really it. She did not land on any island anywhere. So, you know, these bones, there's so many other possibilities. Again, it's a very thin line of evidence anyway. There's so many other people that this could have been. And as I said, he wasn't even able to say that these are the bones of a woman, just that we can't be sure that they are the bones of a man, which is not the same thing. You know what I mean? So he's basically making an argument from ignorance. We really can't know what sex they were. So they could be a woman, you know.
There you go.
Every now and then somebody trots out some kind of evidence. We talked about the picture from like a few months ago. Remember that?
Yeah.
Saying that they have evidence of Amelia Earhart surviving past, you know, her flight. And none of it's credible, to be honest with you. So anyway, just wanted to clarify that. I wasn't trying to imply that I thought that the claims themselves were credible. And I basically don't normally do that on science or fiction. You know, have as science a story that I don't find credible. But I thought I'd make this one tricky, but I do think it probably kind of backfired because it confused some of our listeners.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably just won't do that again.
Yeah, Steve.
Yeah.
Hope you learned your lesson.
Yeah. It's all a learning exercise. All right, guys. Are you ready for science or fiction?
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think the theme is?
Steve Hawking.
Pie.
Stephen Hawking.
Oh, Stephen the theme Hawking. Is well, Stephen Hawking.
Anyone could guess that.
So these are three facts about Stephen Hawking in his honor. Since he, as we discussed earlier in the show, he passed away on the day we're recording the show. So are you guys ready?
Absolutely.
Okay, yes. Here we go. Item number one. Hawking did not learn to read until he was 8 and did poorly in school. Item number two. Hawking almost died in 1985 from pneumonia, but his wife would not let them take him off the ventilator, and instead he was given a tracheostomy. And item number three. Although he never won a Nobel Prize, Hawking was knighted by the Queen in recognition for his contributions to science. Jay, go first.
Hawking did not learn to read until he was 8, and he did poorly in school. You know, I think that one is science. I think it is. I think that he definitely did not learn to read until he was 8. And that is, you know, what you start learning to read, like, what, 5-ish, 4 to 5?
4, 3.
Yeah,
four.
Well, even five, before then. Yeah. Simple sentences, very simple sentences.
So let's move on to the next one. Hawking almost died in 85 from pneumonia, but his wife would not let them take him off of the ventilator. I don't know about that one. I just don't know. Let me read the next one. Although he never won a Nobel Prize, Hawking was knighted. I do not believe Hawking was knighted. I think that one is the fake.
Okay, Evan?
Not learning to read until 8 and poorly in school. I'm leaning that one as science. We hear this about many very brilliant people who had sort of these early adolescent learning issues that they had to sort of overcome and cope with. So I don't think he will have been any different, from those other people in history. And then the next one about that he almost died in 1985 from pneumonia. I had not heard that. Thank goodness for his wife, if that is the case, that they didn't let him take him off the ventilator. Oh, my gosh, that would have been just a terrible waste. But I really don't know this one. You either know it or you don't, and I don't know. The last one, never won a Nobel Prize, correct. Knighted by the Queen. Again, I think I'm with Jay on this one. I don't believe he was knighted by the Queen. Perhaps there was a nomination or some sort of offer for there to be knighthood, and I don't believe that he accepted it. So I'll say that that one's the fiction.
Okay, Kara?
I think I'm with the guys on this one. The first one, he didn't learn to read until he was 8 and did poorly in school, I feel like is the distractor. That's like, no way that's the right one, but then that's the one you pick because it is right. In The Theory of Everything, like the movie about his life, didn't he almost die in a movie theater? Something happened in a movie theater. Or a theater, not a movie theater, like an opera or something. I don't know. But, you know, there is a point in ALS for a lot of people when they decide to trach or not to trach. And then that really does extend their life. So this could, and also I'm sure he had a lot of health scares over the years. You know, the fact that he lived to be, what, 76 is just incredible with ALS. So this one doesn't really surprise me, but I think we would call him Sir Stephen Hawking. We call everybody else, like, at some point, you know, like Sir Richard Branson or Sir David Attenborough. Like, we use that. And I don't know if I've ever just heard that roll off of somebody's tongue. I wouldn't be surprised if he did have some, like, crazy, amazing accolades, but I don't think he was knighted either. So I'm going to go with the fiction on that one.
And Bob. Yeah, at first, for the first one there about not learning to read until he was 8, yeah, similar rumors float around Einstein famously, but that wasn't true. But so this one I was like initially skeptical, but then I'm like, yeah, it sort of rang a bell. It's been a while since I've read any of his books, but that kind of rings a bell. And so does the second one. I seem to remember something about him having a tracheostomy and having some trouble about it. And I think he was actually very concerned that was going to prevent him from talking, what little talking he was able to do or what sounds he could make. So I think that one has a kernel of truth in there. But yeah, everyone else is making sense here. I've never heard of him being knighted, never heard of Sir Stephen Hawking or anything like that. And it wouldn't surprise me if he wasn't, although he probably should have, would have been cool. But I'll say that one's fiction as well.
All right. So you guys are all in agreement. So we could take these in order. Number one, Hawking did not learn to read until he was 8 and did poorly in school. You guys all think that one is science. That one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah, that's yes. Like, yay. It's almost a cliche now, right?
I mean,
like you think of, yeah, they say that about everybody who was famously brilliant. But in his case, it was true. You know, he's definitely a late learner and described himself in interviews as lazy
I've heard work, that too. Mm-hmm.
Didn't really work very hard at school, but still had a reputation for being brilliant. His wow. nickname in school was Einstein. They literally called him Einstein.
Gosh.
Like Einstein.
That's awesome.
And he got – so his father, who didn't have a lot of money, was worried that he wasn't going to get a scholarship for university. He went to Oxford. But he – because his grades were poor, his performance – he was like in the bottom half of his class. But he did so well on the exams that he got in with the scholarship.
Sweet.
I feel bad. He's probably bored, bored in school.
So he says that he didn't really start working hard until he got his ALS diagnosis.
And
then that was kind of a kick in the ass. And then that turned him into the person that he was, that famous.
It was a catalyst.
Absolutely. Well, according to him, that was the sort of the turning point. He was prior to that, he was brilliant, but lazy and just an underachiever. It's interesting. Again, kind of like, iconic notion, but turns out to be true in his case. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go on. Number two, Hawking almost died in 1985 from pneumonia, but his wife would not let them take him off the ventilator, and instead he was given a tracheostomy. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yes! We sweep him!
Good job, guys. Yeah, obviously you've been reading all about Hawking today for the show. Oh. I figured you guys would have come across these, but anyway, I thought it'd be fun.
Yeah.
So... yes, in the life of most patients with ALS, you get to the point where it's either trach or die. That's the choice.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And in fact, when they do clinical trials to see, looking for drugs that might slow the progress, death and tracheostomy are treated as the same outcome.
Really?
Yeah. So in other words, they see how long do people with ALS have tracheostomy-free survival. That's the outcome. Because otherwise... again, you either die or you survive for years with a trach. You know what I mean? So you can't.
But you have round the clock care. You can't take care of yourself.
That's right. You can't compare those two. But that also was the moment where he completely lost his voice. Any mild ability to talk was gone at that point. And so that's when he had to adopt his famous computer synth voice, that we all are familiar with.
Yep.
Yeah, that was in 85. Wow. Which means that although he never won a Nobel Prize, Hawking was knighted by the Queen in recognition for his contributions to science is fiction because he did not win the Nobel Prize and he was never knighted. He was offered a knighthood in the 1990s.
Oh, he didn't take it.
And he refused it as protest because of lack of funding of science in the UK.
Interesting. Oh. That's cool.
He used the opportunity to protest lack of science funding.
Good for him.
So never knighted. No Nobel and never knighted. Oh. He got a lot of other awards.
Oh, sure.
He's definitely recognized. Yeah. So definitely a tremendous figure in science and science communication. Absolutely brilliant guy. And just it is amazing. We kind of take it for granted because we've known him for so long as, again, this sort of iconic figure, sort of wasting away physically in a wheelchair, but a brilliant mind. But just imagine, writing a book, not being able to speak or type or anything. You know what I mean? Just the physical limitations he had to overcome. He's written multiple books, not just one book.
Yeah. I mean, it's at such a slow pace, his mind is moving 1,000 times faster than he can type. Yeah.
Well, he also said that, with the loss of his physical ability from ALS, he had to spend a lot of time in his own head just thinking about cosmology.
Sure. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, I remember reading that because he was doing that and so much in his head and not being able to even, easily, go over and pick up a book and do stuff. He was so in his head that he was able to visualize certain problems in unique ways that other astronomers or astrophysicists didn't probably do as well as he could, and led to perhaps some of the breakthroughs that he made.
Well, good job, everyone. You did your homework for the show.
Yes. Yep.
It paid off.
All right. Good night.
All right. Evan, you have a quote for us?
Well, here is, I think, what would be the obvious quote for tonight. And you're all, I believe, familiar with this. Remember to look up at the stars and not down at your feet. Try to make sense of what you see and wonder about what makes the universe exist. Be curious. And however difficult life may seem, there is always something you can do and succeed at. It matters that you don't just give up. Professor Stephen Hawking.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this evening.
You got it, brother.
Thank you, Steve. Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.